The Dharma, incomparably profound and exquisite, is rarely met with even in hundreds of thousands of millions of kalpas. We now can see it, hear it, accept and hold it. May we realize the true mind of the Tathagata. Today is day 7 of this 7-day session here at Mount Gita in October 2015, and actually it's the last few hours of day 7. A lot of hard work has been done thus far, and it is especially vital not to let up, because now you have greater power than you have had yet in the whole session, no matter what it feels like, and you can go even deeper yet. And who knows when you'll be able to come back to session again? Who knows what time you'll be able to have to practice daily? Yasutani Roshi used to say that to come to a 7-day session was the equivalent of 2 to 3 years of daily practice. You could get that kind of concentrated practice in session, in particular because the hours go one after the other with practice continuing throughout the day and often through the night. And so a lot of depth can be reached. A lot of things can be let go of during a 7-day session. It's going to be vital to keep the practice going as well afterwards, because you don't want to waste this incredible effort everyone has been making. And you want to take it even deeper, bring it to fruition. Today I would like to share a little bit of a book that is titled in English, The Chant Whip Anthology, A Companion to Zen Practice, translated by Jeffrey L. Broughton with Elise Yoko Watanabe helping. You remember that Hakuin had a very low point in his practice when he had basically given up Zen practice. After he learned that Ganto had died screaming and assumed, therefore, that Ganto had gone to hell. And, of course, what brought Hakuin to practice was a fear of hell. And so he began to think that Zen practice wouldn't free him from going to hell. He'd be stuck anyway. And so he may as well join the rest of the world in heading right there. And so he started studying Chinese poetry and calligraphy. And after some months, there's something empty about it. And he also began to realize he really wasn't going to have a fulfilling life being a calligrapher or a poet, that he, among other things, he wasn't that great at it. But still, there was this emptiness, it seems, in his decision to go in that direction. And so he was at a temple at the time where they had just finished airing the books, doing the spring airing of the scrolls, which you already heard about in an earlier Taisho. And he decided that he would go up and pick up one of those scrolls and move it to a point where he would do this essentially with his eyes closed, pick out a passage without calculating it. And so he did that, closed his eyes and opened the thing, pointed to a passage, and it came up with something out of the traditional book called Spurring Students Through the Chan Gates, or the Zen Gates. And this is a translation of exactly that book. It's rather traditional, and I'd like to share with you just a little bit about it. What it is a collection of teachings, quotes from the ancient masters, some things out of the sutras, and they were all put together by a Chinese monk many centuries ago, and exactly to help inspire Zen students along the path. This is Chan Master Du Feng Shan of Chan Zen instructs the Sangha. If you wish to achieve liberation from samsara, samsara is basically everyday life the way we live it. Being caught in our stuff, being pulled around by the nose, by greed, anger, and most of all by the illusion that we are somebody, some fixed self that doesn't change, that we find a need to defend. We find often in defending it can even go to extremity, like this one of the recent of many, unfortunately, killings on college campuses where a young man decided the way to make a name for himself was to go and kill a bunch of people. He saw that this had happened in the past, that, and this is in part the responsibility of the press for, in essence, glorifying by constantly repeating information about these killings, glorifying them. And obviously this young man was a bit mixed up. He was a loner, as so often they are, not fitting into society. And he decided that he would go and kill a bunch of people to make a name for himself. And so he did. He did kill something like 14 people at random in a college campus. And then when the police were catching up with him, he turned the gun on himself. This is an extreme version of attachment to a self-image. The fact that the members of ISIL in the Middle East are willing to kill anybody who doesn't believe in the exact form of Islam that they do also is another expression of it. It truly is a source of pain and suffering, this clinging to attachment of various sorts, and the primary attachment being to a self-image. And yet when we can see through that self-image, which is a big challenge, and this is why Zen practice can be such a challenge for people, and probably why so many people never follow through to the very final point of it, as it is challenging, and we don't like what we see, and we also can eventually, what frequently happens is that we come up against a fear of death because we assume that this self-image lives, that that's who we are, and that if we let that go, we're going to be nobody. We're going to disappear. We're going to die. It's interesting that in Asia, every year, the dead are remembered. And it is said that if the dead are not remembered, if you don't remember your family members going back generations, chanting for them and offering them symbolic food and cleaning the graves and so on and so forth, that they will disappear. If nobody's remembering them, they'll disappear. The irony is that the Buddha nature is beyond birth and death. So how can you possibly disappear? Again, it's an ego viewpoint. And here we don't want to disparage ego, because a person needs a healthy ego to be mentally, emotionally healthy. But where we get in trouble is assuming that that is exactly who we are, and that we have to maintain that, we have to defend that. And so often in America, for whatever reason, the Puritan ethic, original sin. It's hard to know what the source of it is. I think there are probably many sources, as well as a human tendency to blame and to put down people. That so many Americans have negative self-images, and we try to keep that under wraps. In fact, often we're not even aware of it ourselves, but it comes out in our interactions with people in an unconscious disdain of other people, for example. And it's important through our practice, as part of our deepening, as part of our work on ultimately becoming totally free to express our innate wisdom and compassion in everything we do or say or think, that we open to whatever is buried inside, bring it to light, because then it can be let go of. Otherwise, it functions subconsciously, and we run into heavy water. Sometimes we don't understand why people have reactions to us, but if we could really, really see ourselves clearly, it would be more obvious. And it does not mean that we're bad people. This is really, really important to recognize. It's just that we have made an assumption that we're bad. We've made an assumption based on ways we grew up, things that were said to us. And particularly if we grew up in dysfunctional families, which so many of us did, then that's likely to be pretty rampant. So, Chan Master Du Feng Shan of Chan Zen instructs the Sangha, if you wish to achieve liberation from samsara, first you must produce the mind of great confidence and make the four great vows. If you haven't smashed the case you are probing, that is the koan, seeing clearly your face before your father and mother conceived you, and severed even the tiniest conditioned dharmas, that's phenomena, manifesting right in front of you, then you must make a vow not to let go of the cue you've been probing up until now. The cue is something that's also called the wado, or the nub of the koan. For example, the koan, who am I? Who is the nub of the koan? The koan, does the dog have the Buddha nature? No, that mu or no is the nub of the koan or the cue, and it's if you have an innate koan, a birth koan, then what is most important, regardless of what koan you're working on, is to have that curiosity, that perplexity, really. About the koan, this perplexity. There's something I've been somehow aware of existing since I was a small child, just beyond the reach of my consciousness. What is it? That kind of perplexity. And if you have a koan, then who am I really? Who am I really? If I'm not this bundle of assumptions, who am I really? Then you must make a vow not to let go of the cue you've been probing up until now, not to separate yourself from a real teacher, and not covetously to pursue fame and profit. If on purpose you contravene this vow, you will fall into a bad rebirth path. If you produce this great vow and protect this mindset, then for the first time you will be able to grasp the case as my thing. That is, it will become real and compelling to you. Perhaps you're keeping an eye on the Wu character or the Mu character. It's Wu in Chinese or Mu in Japanese. The crux lies in applying your strength to why does Joshu's dog not have the Buddha nature? Perhaps you're keeping an eye on the 10,000 dharmas return to the one. The crux lies in to what place does the one return? Perhaps you're probing the Nembutsu. That's I place my faith in Amida Buddha. The crux lies in who is doing the Nembutsu. Retrain the light of the true mind backward. Enter deeply into the sensation of indecision and apprehension, which translates really to perplexity. If you're keeping an eye on the cue does not gain you energy, then again raise to full awareness the previous text, in other words, the case, right down to any line at the end. Repeat the entire case from start to finish continuously, and then there will be a means by which you can bring about this perplexity. When the sensation of indecision and apprehension is continuous, urgently concentrate. You will unconsciously take a stride and flip over, doing a somersault while suspended in midair. In other words, experience the great death. That's the time to come once again to eat my stick. And then one more short one. This is Chan Master Konggu Long instructs the Sangha. You must not engage in minding the cue like a spaced out idiot. In other words, we don't want to just repeat who, 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 who. It is the perplexity that we want to dive into. The koan provides a vehicle for that. You must also not engage in intellectual examination of the cue and try to figure it out. At all times, you must be furious in your clarification of this matter. Suddenly, hanging over a precipice, you will let go of your hold and do a body flip. It sounds like we've got a bunch of acrobats here. Then, for the first time, you will see the clear, solitary brightness of the one mind. Even though you've reached this point, you must not wallow in it. There is still the hammer blow to the back of the head, and this barrier is extremely difficult to pass through. In any case, go on probing the cue in that way. There's a reference to the hammer blow to the back of the head, but it actually is just the Chinese characters. But what that really means is we have a Kensho experience and we can't sit down there. We have to keep going. We have to A, deepen it, and B, we have to bring it to life in our life. We can't just hang out in that pleasant mind state. That's worse than not having a Kensho at all. That's what Hakuin had done, actually, originally. It was first Kensho. He was so enraptured, which should have given him a cue, that he just kind of was full of himself for weeks on end. And he had decided that he had had the deepest Kensho anybody had ever had in years, decades, hundreds of years, actually. And then he began to realize that the mind state and his daily living didn't seem to match. And there's another clue. The mind state and the daily living didn't match. And that's when, thankfully, he took himself back to serious practice and eventually encountered Dokyo Eitan, who also really, really gave him a hard time and disabused him of this idea that he was this deeply enlightened human being. And it was through Dokyo Eitan and through Hakuin's exertions under his care that Hakuin continued to have further Kensho experiences. And it wasn't until the monks he had been traveling with caught up with him, and he knew they were not as serious as he was about the practice. And Dokyo Eitan had this tiny little cottage, which still exists, outside of Iyama, kind of quite in the boondocks still in Japan. And he wasn't a famous monk, and he didn't have throngs of followers, and he didn't have throngs of supporters. He could barely manage to feed himself. And so anyone who came to train with him also had to go out and provide his own meals and clothing and whatever else he needed. And eventually, when Hakuin was called back to his hometown of Hara to take over what had gone into disrepair, the family temple, Shoinji, he also lived very sparely, necessarily so, because it had fallen into disrepair, because it really didn't have any financial support. And it was some time before he could gain enough to support the temple and rebuild the roofs. He had to go around with a raincoat on, basically, a Japanese version of a raincoat, even inside the building, because the roofs leaked so badly. And it does rain a lot in Japan. I'd like to shift a little bit and now share something from a book called The Mirror of Zen, which again was one of the ancient texts, not as ancient as the sutras, but this one is Korean. And it was written by a Korean master who was born in 1540 in what's now North Korea. His name was Sosan. And when he was 9 years old, his mother died. And when he was 10 years old, his father died. And so suddenly he was orphaned. And the county magistrate sort of took him under his wing and his sort of informal adoption and made sure that he had an education, sent him to a Confucian school, which is the elite schools of the era, and there he trained. But then his teacher had to go back home to a different city after a family member died and left the students alone. And so he, along with some of the other students, went exploring, and they found themselves at a Zen temple. Zen in Korean is called Son. And there he learned how to do Zazen. And it says that at the age of 21, he was awakened. So, after 8 years of continuous study, one day while walking through a village, he attained sudden enlightenment at the sound of a cock crowing, and he wrote a verse to express his experience. Didn't they say in the old days that your mind does not turn gray even though your hair does? In hearing the sound of a cock crowing, a great person's work is fulfilled. And in those days, I don't know if it's true today or not, I should ask some of my Korean monastic friends, you had to take a very, very serious state exam, that one of the higher exams for employee in the state system. And if you passed that, you were eligible to enter into monastic life. And he passed that. And now I'd like to share a little bit of his teaching. There's only one thing from the very beginning, infinitely bright and mysterious by nature. It was never born and it never dies. It cannot be described or given a name. What is this one thing? This is the crux of our practice. There is only one thing from the very beginning, infinitely bright and mysterious by nature. It was never born and it never dies. It cannot be described or given a name. But we name it anyway. We call it Buddha nature. Christians call it God, but the actual experience of God has largely died out in the Christian church. Here and there are some who experienced it. I have a friend in Albuquerque, actually, who was a Catholic nun, and she was sent to Japan. And while she was in Japan, she discovered that the some of the Catholic monastics were sitting zazen with a Catholic priest, Father Enamia LaSalle, who Kapla Roshi knew personally. He had a little zendo, and he was a student, I believe, of Yasutani Roshi. At any rate, quite a few contemporary Catholic priests and nuns sat zazen with Father LaSalle. And a number reached a Kensho experience through that, including Ruben Abito, who teaches at the Maria Kanon Zen Center in Dallas-Fort Worth, Texas, and also Joan Rick in Albuquerque. And Joan had a Kensho experience and concluded that she was a bad nun because what she understood did not accord necessarily with certain of the teachings of the Catholic Church. And so she left the nunnery and went back into lay life. But she also stayed on in Japan and continued training in Zen and ultimately was given transmission in the Sambo Kyodan school, which is a parallel school. It's Yasutani Roshi's Dharma successors, now in the third generation after him. His first successor was Yamada Koen, and now the school is headed by his son, another Yamada, and I don't remember his first name or his Buddhist name. What is this one thing, mysterious, beyond description? Numinous emptiness is one attempt to describe it. What is this? This is whatever it was that so many of us have sensed, even as small children, lay just beyond conscious awareness. And this is what does bring many of us to Zen practice. And we can experience this. It's called awakening. Awakening, by the way, comes in various different forms. Most awakenings these days are relatively shallow. It's extremely rare to have a deeper awakening, although that did happen to Flora Courtois, as evidenced by the fact that 20 years later, it was still alive and functioning in her life, to the point where Yasutani Roshi didn't think it was necessary to test her. There is only one thing from the very beginning, infinitely bright and mysterious by nature. It was never born and it never dies, cannot be described or given a name. What is this one thing? And then there's a commentary. An eminent teacher wrote, even before the ancient Buddhas were born, one thing was already perfectly complete. Even Shakyamuni Buddha could not understand it. How could he transmit it to Mahakashapa? There is one thing that is never born and never dies. For this reason, it cannot be named in any way or expressed or depicted. The sixth patriarch of Zen once addressed the assembly thus: I have something that has no name and no form. Do any of you see it? Zen Master Shenhui immediately replied, It is the essence of all Buddhas and also my Buddha nature. Due to this answer, Shenhui cannot be considered a legitimate heir and descendant of the sixth patriarch. Why not? What was there about that answer that wasn't quite right? Zen Master Nyan Yue came from Mount Sung San to see the sixth patriarch, who asked, What is it that comes here like this? Nan Yue was completely stuck, couldn't answer anything. After 8 years of practice, he finally attained enlightenment and said, If you even call this a thing, it is not correct. This answer is why Nan Yue thus became the premier Dharma heir and successor of the sixth patriarch. And then there's a gatha. The sages of the three great teachings can be found in this phrase. Who dares express it must be careful. Your eyebrows may fall out. There is an old saying that if you give a wrong teaching, your eyebrows will fall out. If you mislead people, your eyebrows will fall out. There is only one thing from the very beginning, infinitely bright and mysterious by nature. It was never born and it never dies. It cannot be described or given a name. What is this one thing? And I leave you with that to puzzle over. Take deep into your hara. Not the words of it, but the perplexity that it engenders. And keep it close to your heart through your hara as you continue your life beyond this sesshin, and bring it to life in your practice again and again and again. And ultimately, you will have the great joy of truly recognizing that one thing. Thank you for listening, and we'll stop now and recite the four vows.